Hello, John.
Yes.
Hey. Welcome back to the real world.
Thanks, boy. Feels strange being here. It's been so long.
Yeah, it's been, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks?
I think it's been 3 weeks. So you talked to, you talked to Bob Wright about sleep.
Oh, yeah, about sleep and insomnia, and then Christine Keneally about languages and shipwrecked babies in the Galapagos.
Yeah, but those were great chats, and it was weird the sort of self-referential quality to both. So you and Bob were both apparently sleep-deprived when you were talking, and then, of course, whenever you're talking about linguistics, there's this kind of weird mirror quality to it.
Yeah, that's true, this kind of Hofstadterian loop. Self-reference.
Yeah.
And yeah, I really like that stuff. Well, I really enjoyed your talk with Bob and finding out all kinds of things about him that I didn't know.
We just scratched the surface. I mean,
Bob was... And you're still... You managed to guard the family secrets pretty carefully, I thought. And yeah.
You mean my own secrets?
Yeah, like prep school and...
Oh, I have no secrets. I just didn't think anybody would be interested. No, Bob was, divulged some really interesting stuff about his childhood, some of which I hadn't heard before.
Yeah.
But then he put the door down, probably wisely.
Yeah, it was very very good conversation, though. I think of it as the gold standard.
Oh, well, thank you.
It was really good.
Well, I have to say, it's a little daunting to be back to Blogging Heads, because I feel as though the bar has been raised now. I mean, you got this mailing from Blogging Heads with all the new and improved guidelines?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I think a lot of that was already in place. It's just getting more emphasis.
I hope it doesn't
become overproduced, although I don't think that's probably a huge worry.
Well, as long as they have us here, there's no danger of that.
Well, yeah, GarageBand TV, that's how I described it to Christine. And I think that's part of the appeal, I think.
That's a nice phrase. Well, at least I guess as a result of this New York Times syndication, we're all getting $1,000 a show, so that's a good thing.
That's a good rumor. I think that's the number has too many ones on it.
I couldn't get you to bite on that, huh?
So
it's just ludicrous on its face.
It is unfortunately true, but
maybe
so,
someday.
So where have you were in Portugal, right?
Yeah, it's Lisbon? So I go for months or years with nobody wanting to hear anything that I have to say. And then, I get invitations to speak in clusters. So I had this cluster of talks that I had to give over the last couple of weeks. And by far the most interesting and exotic was at a conference in Lisbon, mm-hmm. Portugal. On the title is Science Near Its Limits?
And, you wrote a book about something about that,
yeah.
Right?
Well, it turns out that that the end of science meme infected the mind of a very prominent literary critic named George Steiner.
Yeah, I saw that. I was wondering, why Steiner would be hosting a conference on science or the end of science, or so it's because you read your book.
Well, apparently so. So he's somebody who's always, I used to love reading his essays in the 70s and 80s in the New Yorker.
Uh-huh.
And he's somebody who likes to take on grand ideas. So I thought, I guess the end of science was just grand or grandiose or pretentious enough for him to seize upon it. And he's been trying to convince this organization called the Gulbenkian Foundation in Lisbon for about 10 years to host this conference, and they finally did. Now, just the story behind the Gulbenkian Foundation is interesting in itself. Have you ever heard of this Gulbenkian?
I hadn't until I heard you were going there, and then when Peter Woit He was there too, right? The guy who who writes the Not Even Wrong website.
Yes.
And a book called Not Even Wrong. Yeah. So I saw his posting about you being there, and then I went and clicked over to look at the website for the conference. But that was the first time I'd heard of the Galbenkian Foundation.
Well, the Kalust Galbenkian was an Armenian who was born in around 1870 or so in Turkey, and by the time he was 30 or 40 years old, he controlled a substantial portion of the world's oil reserves.
Huh.
And I'd never heard of him, but this is a guy who was a major figure in world history, and particularly in Eastern Europe and the Middle East. Mm-hmm. He, at one time, he controlled the entire Iraqi oil reserve, big
wow.
chunks of Saudi Arabia,
huh.
and he helped the great powers carve all that up in the 20s and 30s.
Wow.
And as a result, he became a very, very wealthy man, and he ended up settling in Lisbon and left his fortune to this foundation, which promotes culture and science. It's got a beautiful museum there in Lisbon based on his personal collection. And it's like the Met in New York. It was one of the most amazing collections I'd ever seen.
Wow.
Every kind of art, from ancient Egyptian art right up to the present.
Wow.
And they flew us first class all the way over. Everything was just top of the line. Oh, man, it was such a trip.
Oh, that sounds great. That's wonderful.
And the meeting was pretty cool, too.
Yeah, I got the impression from White's blog that you had a bit of a chilly reception from some of your old nemesis.
Yeah. Well, that was part of what made it really interesting to me was that some of my co-speakers were people I'd interviewed in the past or encountered in various ways. One was Gerald Edelman, a Nobel laureate and neuroscientist.
Oh, Gerald Edelman as in neural Edelmanism. Neural Darwinism.
Well, yes, except that Francis Crick thought that it should be neural Edelmanism. We can get into that in a little bit.
Because no one else could understand the theory.
That's right.
Yeah.
Then Freeman Dyson, who's
oh.
I think we both are fans of his,
yeah.
he was there also. And, of course, George Steiner, who's this really remarkable figure. But Lewis Wolpert, a British biologist, I had a very serious run-in with him about 10 years ago.
A furious run-in?
Well, he was just... This was while I was in London peddling the end of science.
Uh-huh.
And I was at a reception with all these British scientists and... journalist, John Maynard Smith had just given a talk, and we all met afterwards. And Wolpert was introduced to me, and he became so apoplectic at the sight of me that I swear I thought he was going to sock me one.
Oh.
He just started sputtering in my face how awful my book was, and he was especially upset by my treatment of neuroscience. So I had a chapter called The End of Neuroscience
right,
in my
right.
book. And Wolpert said, first of all, I hadn't interviewed any real neuroscientists. I just interviewed Francis Crick, who's a physicist, and Roger Penrose, who's a physicist, and Gerald Edelman, who's just an immunologist, for Christ's sake. So he was really chiding me. And then the problem was he went stalking away before I could respond.
Yeah.
And actually, what I wanted to tell him was that... I agreed with him, and I thought I needed to devote much more time to the science of the brain and mind than I did in The End of Science before dismissing it, and so
yeah.
that was my second book.
Right,
but
right.
Wolpert was there. He was great. We made up.
Oh, good.
What I wanted to start by saying was what I thought was the most newsworthy event at this meeting, which was that Wolf Singer,
mm-hmm.
who is one of the leading neuroscientists in the world.
Oh, yeah, memories particularly, right?
Well, not only memory, he's the person who popularized this. It's called a population code when you have large numbers of neurons that are firing at the same frequency and at exactly the same time. So these are called... synchronous oscillations. Mm-hmm. And especially there's one particular oscillation about 40 hertz, 40 firings per second of the neurons that he thought might be important. And Francis Crick and Christoph Koch later seized on this as a possible solution to the problem of consciousness, that 40 hertz oscillations sort of bound together the firing of diverse groups of neurons. But anyway, so...
Was it the alpha? Is it called the alpha frequency, or...
Oh, God, I can't I can't remember.
Alpha, beta, it was what... It was, anyway.
One of those...
Neither here nor there. Maybe the theta rhythm.
But listen to this. So he... So Singer, you know, almost everybody just... They gave a talk about their work, their pet theory, and so forth. So Singer did that. He updated us on synchronous oscillations. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of his talk, and this wasn't a total surprise to me because he'd been speaking about this at lunch, but I never thought he'd mention it in his public speech. He said that he had just been to Nepal and had met these Tibetan monks there, or Buddhist monks, who had claimed to have psychic powers. To be able to, you know, they were clairvoyant. They claimed to be clairvoyant, and you know, have all these, you know, supernatural capabilities.
A lot of people claim that.
But, well, but Singer took it seriously
because they were Buddhist monks, or did he actually see a demonstration that
he said he wasn't convinced, but he said he was open-minded to the possibility that psychic phenomena are real, and he was urging his fellow scientists to start investigating ESP. Yeah. And then, in what was clearly the understatement of the whole meeting, he said, you know, if we do validate the existence of ESP, this will require some serious revision of our theories.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit, you know, so it raised this whole issue, because I had thought, I don't know, you have to tell me what you think about ESP. I had thought we sort of had decided once and for all, ESP is not real.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, research still goes on, and occasionally someone will, you know, claim to find just a slight little statistical variation in some guessing game that they say, oh, well, look, this may be a little glimmer of ESP, but I think in every case I know of, it's been, you know, people were able to dismiss it as a statistical fluke, and in any case, it wasn't a very big fluctuation.
Well, so what, I mean, just give me your gut feeling. Do you think this is real?
No,
I mean, all the time we've expended on it.
No, I don't.
You don't.
But, okay. I mean, obviously,
you're such a wet blanket, George.
No, I mean, the understate. I mean, you have to come up with some kind of mechanism for how, you know, I suppose that, you know, you could concoct some theory that involved electromagnetic resonance between one brain or another if it was, you know, if you were, like, touching foreheads or something, but...
Yeah.
But you know, to produce enough energy to be like a radio wave signal, you know, stretching for, you know, miles, you know, you'd think that, you know, that would have, you know, shown up on someone's EEG, but, you know, maybe it's all vibrating in some extra dimension, or it's some kind of energy that hasn't been discovered yet. So, yeah, it would definitely cause them to have to readjust some of their theories, I think, not just of neuroscience and biology, but of physics.
Absolutely. I mean,
yeah.
That would be...
But there's always, you know, people that, you know, still, you know, hold out some kind of belief, often based on personal experience, in ESP and paranormal phenomena, including a lot of physicists. And
absolutely.
Yeah, like when I was... brainstorming for examples for a piece I did in the Week in Review recently about Nobel laureates who've kind of, you know, gone off the end and said...
Which I love, by the way.
Great
piece. It was a great way to sort of... I like, you know, it was sort of an oblique way of getting at it, but in a way it was sort of the important meta issue.
Well, yeah, that's what interested me, because so much had been written about... the issue itself, you know.
Yes.
And in the Week in Review, they try to, you know, you try to find some, you know, use an event in the news as a tangent to, you know, write about some, you know, interesting ideas. And actually, I, you know, I'd sent you an email before that asking for your suggestion, and you had mentioned Brian Josephson.
Yes.
Yeah, who got a Nobel Prize for work involving superconductivity, and mm-hmm. Josephson believes in ESP. And then when I did a little more research for the story, I found this wonderful example that I talked to Christine about, where the British mail service, the Royal Mail, had issued commemorative stamps for the Nobel Prize centenary. And there was a pamphlet published by the Royal Mail that came out with it, in which they talked about different issues in science, and they had this line that about the, you know, the wonderful world that quantum mechanics had opened up, and how you know, this could lead to solution of all kinds of long-standing problems, including ESP.
Right.
Yeah, and then, you know, all these people kind of scientists in Britain reacted, you know, with astonishment, and then it turned out they'd gotten that from Brian Josephson.
I couldn't believe that they didn't vet that.
Yeah.
In advance. You know, when I was at this conference, Wolf Singer spoke on the first day, and I spoke on the second day, and as usual, there are a couple of people who spoke about string theory there, so
yeah.
Peter White was putting it down, of course, but then there were at least two speakers, particle physicists from CERN, who were defending string theory very strongly, and I thought it would be, so I, you know, I'm taking my usual shots at string theory in my talk,
yeah.
And I thought it would be funny to say that, you know, in a reference to what Wolf Singer had said, that maybe the answer to string theory's problems is that they should propose a new particle called the psychon, which mm-hmm. would involve paranormal effects.
Yeah.
And I ended up not doing that. But I was Googling Brian Josephson to see what he'd been saying recently,
yeah.
And it turns out...
Psychons?
He has written a paper called String Theory, Universal Mind, and the Paranormal.
Oh.
I'll put a link to it on our site. You know, I couldn't really understand quite how it works, but I think he said that you have quantum vacuum bubbles
mm-hmm.
In the brains of string theorists that... God, I'm not sure how it works. That's all I remember. It's quantum vacuum bubbles and the brains of string theorists, which actually, on, you know, sort of on the surface, makes sense.
Yeah.
It seems sort of plausible.
Yeah.
But, you know, so you're trying to, you know, here I was trying to come up with a parody of these ideas, and it turns out that there's somebody, a Nobel laureate,
yeah.
who is proposing them seriously.
Wow.
You know, another person at this conference, Freeman Dyson, who I just mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
no,
he
said something about ESP, right?
That's right. He wrote a review, which I was just stunning to me. It came out, jotted this down. I think it was about 3 years ago in the New York Review of Books. He reviewed a couple of books on the paranormal.
Yeah.
And it, you know, sort of a straightforward review, but at the very end, he Dyson said that he believed in what he calls psi, which is sort of the British term for ESP.
Yeah.
And he has, I think it was an aunt who was a very important figure in the British Psychical Society.
Oh, yeah.
And so I actually, after Singer's talk in Lisbon, I sought out Dyson and asked him what he thought. And he said, his take was sort of interesting. He said, he didn't think that science would ever pin down ESP. Dyson was sure it was real.
Huh.
But he thought that ESP only occurs under when somebody is under severe stress of some kind or is undergoing a traumatic experience, and therefore it can't be replicated in a laboratory. It also means he doesn't think that you can be sort of a professional psychic and have these, you know, mind-reading ability,
yeah.
or clairvoyance at will.
Well, for him to say something like that, I mean, he must have had some experience that he you know, attribute that he, you know, he feels like he experienced some kind of extrasensory perception or knows someone, you know, very closely who he trusts implicitly who claims that. I mean,
almost all people...
There's no evidence for it. It would have to be some strong subjective gut feeling that something happened that they couldn't explain any other way. And
Wolf Singer, when he was talking about this over lunch before his talk, his public talk, said that he'd had an experience where he was in a strange city and he lost his children.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he found them in a way that was really sort of logically impossible. He found his way to them going on this kind of hunch, and he was in a very distressed state of mind, and he found them, and he thought that maybe that was some sort of psychic experience. So in his case, there was a personal experience. I think you're right that people have these, if you have that sort of experience, you can't explain it logically. You seize on this possibility that there are paranormal effects at work.
Yeah, but then, you know, whenever you have anything like that that appears to be an anomaly, you know, you can always, you know, fit it into the dominant framework, you know, say that there was some kind of unconscious mental processing going on in his mind that suggested this place for what actually were logical reasons and some connections that he'd just forgotten, or again, that it was just random. I mean, obviously, if you lose your children in a large city, they're not going to be very far away.
Yeah.
You know, unless, you know, they jumped on a bus or a train or were, you know, abducted by aliens or child kidnappers. But, you know, there's some, you know, some people would, you know, really struggle. I think that's what I would do, to try to find a sensible explanation that fit into the way that we believe the world works, you know, and
yes,
the experience of thousands of years of civilization and hundreds of years of science, and yet other people kind of are looking for something to take this leap into, you know, the idea that, maybe there's some big mystery that's still lurking out there. You know, like Jungian synchronicity, where, you know, you have two things that seem to be coincidental, and yet really there's an acausal connecting principle. And, well, maybe there is, and of course, you know, quantum mechanics is acausal, so you can, you know, concoct these pseudoscientific edifices.
Yeah, it's, you know, I realize, though, that I think you and I might be in the minority on this. Most people... So I
was you believing in ESP? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, but I mean, even among scientists, so I was at this, when Singer was talking at this table, there were maybe eight people at the table over lunch, and he was describing his meeting these monks, and then Singer describes his own experience, and basically everybody's kind of nodding and saying, oh yeah, I've, you know, had those sorts of experiences too, and oh, you know, there's something going on there, and I was flabbergasted.
Yes, so you've never had an experience like that?
I have had experiences like that, but I guess I rule them out as, you know, there is such a thing as dumb luck.
Yeah, yeah.
And coincidences.
Yeah, a lot of amazing coincidences, quote unquote, turn out not to be so amazing when you really do the math.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I personally, since science is so moribund now, I would love to see mainstream scientists start doing research on ESP and so forth. It's just that
still kind of smoldering way off in some remote back burner, right? You know,
yes,
their psychical research, and they still do the experiments where they have the cards with the four little shapes on them, and then you look at them and try to show that the other person sees the card, you know, what the card is, and then is projecting it to you telepathically, supposedly, and you're in different rooms, you can't see the person, so you don't get the clever Hans type unconscious signaling effects, and then they'll try to see if there's a slight statistical variation from chance in you guessing the cards. And I think that still goes on. But God, I remember when I was in probably junior high school, I became fascinated by the idea of ESP, and I'd read some book, and my best friend Ron Light and I would we actually got these cards and did ESP experiments and
did that lead you to believe there's nothing,
nothing
there?
Nothing.
Because I did one of those experiments once with a friend of mine. We just talked about it recently, and when we were 17, 18 years old, and of course we were under the influence of something, and we had a streak of. I think it was a set of five cards, different colors, different shapes.
Yeah.
I forget the name. It was that standard format with a cross and a circle. And anyway,
right.
And we got, I think, I was looking at the card. He's telling me what I've got.
Mm.
And he got 9 in a row, right?
Mm, yeah.
And then we both, I wasn't supposed to tell him if he'd gotten them right until we were all done. But at that point, I started giggling or something. I couldn't, because I thought, obviously, he was psychic. He was reading my mind. So that's always stuck in my head as an odd thing.
Yeah.
As I said, we were both under the influence. So
yeah, it looks like UFOs. I mean, I've certainly seen UFOs, and of course UFOs do exist. There are objects that are flying, and sure enough, they're unidentified. But
yeah.
Everything that I've ever seen like that, I can easily come up with a rational explanation that fits within the framework. That doesn't mean that I'm right, but it's sort of like, when James Randi, the magician, proves that it's possible to bend a spoon like the great psychic Uri Geller does, it's possible to do that purely through trickery, and then he's not actually proving that Geller himself, I guess, is doing this trick, because he's not, like, sneaking behind stage or using X-ray vision or something. But he shows that, there's a perfectly rational, scientific, logical way you could do this and fool people. And it's very persuasive because, it's the old extraordinary claims demand extraordinary proof.
And Randy's got that $1 million standing...
Right. Oh yeah, we talked
prize
about
offer.
That before. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
How about Gerald Edelman? You said he was there, neural Darwinism guy.
Yeah. So I hadn't seen him. I probably wrote the harshest profile I've ever written.
Yeah, I just reread it yesterday when you mentioned that Edelman had been there. It's really, I think, one of the best things in the book, and there's a lot of really great profiles in there.
Well, it was very harsh, though. I would admit that, and I'm going after his theory and his personality, and
he's a very harsh personality, right? So
he does, and I thought that in some cases, sometimes you can describe a scientist's personality, and it's just interesting for its own sake. Ideally, what I try to do is to show that. Understanding the personality helps to understand the theory.
Yeah.
So in Edelman's case, he has this theory that he's tried to create almost an isolation from everything else going on in neuroscience. He's created his own language for it. He calls it neural Darwinism. He's got terms like re-entry. He uses the term group instead of population for large numbers of neurons.
Maybe we should back up a step and say this is a theory of consciousness, consciousness arises from the brain.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'll back up even further. Edelman was somebody who won a Nobel Prize for work in immunology that was very important. He helped to show how the body distinguishes self from non-self.
Yeah, it's a fascinating theory, which involves, it's kind of a lymphocytic Darwinism in a way.
Yeah, so he thought that there was sort of a selection principle going on in the immune response, and he transferred that idea to the brain, and he thought that there are these competitions between large populations of neurons that determine whether you see this shape out there as, for example, a dog or a cat.
Yeah, right.
And the problem with it was that it was actually very similar to things that other people had been saying. It was similar to some ideas that come out of neural network theory. There's this guy named Hebb who had been...
Donald Hebb.
Yeah, I've been creating models of
neurons
the
that fire together, wire together, and
it
really was done in isolation, and plus Edelman would never concede that there was any relationship to his work and anyone else's, and he made other extraordinary claims like that the theory did not involve information processing. Let me see if I can remember what the theory. Like with immunology, okay, the idea was originally people thought, you know, you have these lymphocytes, and it'll find the little invading creature coming, you know, down your bloodstream or wherever, and there'll be an antigen or a little molecular, you know, ID tag on the invader, and it was originally thought that the lymphocyte would, latch on to the invader, and then it would basically detect this antigen signature, mold itself to it, and then go off and bring that signal back to the immune system and say, you know, here's what we're up against, guys. And then the lymph nodes would produce all of these specialized lymphocytes that could lock on to this antigen and then blow up the invader. And then what Edelman went on to show was that actually what happens is that the body makes all these different kinds of antigens that would, I mean, all these different lymphocytes that are lock and key fits to any conceivable antigen or almost any conceivable antigen, and then an invader comes into the body, one of these lymphocytes will eventually stumble upon the invader, and then when it does that, that triggers the marshalling of the lymph nodes, and they make more of these things. So it's very different. And then with the brain, I think he's saying that there's all these, just as the body is making all these, randomly generating all these different kinds of lymphocytes, the brain has all these sort of randomized neural connections, and then if you get a signal, which is like the invader coming in through your senses, some of these patterns of neurons, randomly wired neurons, will respond more strongly than others, and then as a result, the connections between them will be strengthened, and then they'll become sort of a representation of what's going on outside, and it's just sort of the flow of all this. It's a fascinating
theory. That's good, George. Actually, you do a better job explaining it than Edelman.
They call it neural Edelmanism, right? I actually reviewed the book, one of the books he wrote, Bright Air, Brilliant Fire.
Yes, that was sort of his popular version of the theory after he had three highly technical advanced books.
And it was still really difficult, and he's still writing books. I just read one, actually, coincidentally, last week. They're much shorter now. This one was called Second Nature, Brain Science and Human Knowledge. And he, again, you know, he alludes to the theory all throughout the book, but he says, well, I've already explained this elsewhere, so I won't get into the details. But I still don't really get it, and I still don't see how anyone could say that what he's doing is not information processing. What his theory is doing.
Well, he's basically, you know, one of the themes of his writing is that nobody really understands the brain's complexity before he came along. And he also emphasizes that each brain is absolutely unique and is shaped by experience, and neurons are constantly shifting their synaptic connections, which of course is, you know, widely discussed by everybody going back to, you know, the 1920s. But, you know, so he exaggerates his sort of discovery of that aspect of the brain. But then I think in a reaction to cognitive science and artificial intelligence, he says that the brain is not a computer, certainly not a digital computer.
Yeah, but nobody thinks it's a, you know, digital computer per se.
Well, some people, you know, still the computer, most scientists will just say, well, the computer is a useful model for understanding
the brain. Obviously the brain has units that are getting information in the form of signals, processing them and sending out, you know, modified signals, and that's information processing, and that's computation. But Edelman seemed to think, my impression that I got from his book was that there are actually scientists who think that the brain's working like a von Neumann machine, you know, with the same architecture and You know, the idea of a computer is just so much richer and more fluid than that. And
well, the huge contradiction in his work, and this, you know, I just remembered when he gave his talk in Lisbon why I'd had such problems with him, because at first he's so brilliant, and he really, you know, he just has that kind of aura of I'm smarter than all of you put together, and he pulls it off pretty well. He's kind of this creepy looking guy, but he's clearly extremely intelligent, and he's starting to talk and I'm going, my God, this guy, how could I have dared to criticize him? And then as he was talking, I remembered all the problems I had with his presentation.
Yeah.
And the main one was, after going on and on about how the brain is not a computer and ridiculing anybody who would think it is, he presents this video of this robot.
Darwin 7. Right.
Yeah, so when I interviewed him, he was still at Rockefeller University, and he had Darwin 4, I mm-hmm. think. And so I actually went into a room, and he showed me Darwin 4, which is this, you know, heap of this bucket of bolts that was going around and picking up blocks or something.
Right.
And he said it was demonstrating the power of his theory. So it's a robot.
Yeah.
With a computer for a brain.
Yeah,
right,
yeah,
after
yeah.
He
it's,
spent
actually,
all this time.
It's actually hooked to a mainframe computer.
Yeah, right after he spent all this time telling me that the brain is not a computer.
Yeah.
He did it again in Lisbon. He showed us a movie of this robot that was just pathetically limited. It was, in this case, it was playing soccer, and, you know, so it you kick a ball at it, and it has little calipers, grabs the ball,
yeah.
And it kicks it into a goal.
Yeah.
And Edelman has given us this big riff as we're watching to tell us how, you know, this is not computation you're watching. It is something that is based on the competition of different algorithms, and this is what happens in the brain. And I'm thinking,
How is it not computation? That's what.
Right.
I mean, the only thing that where I stumble a little on that is, you can use a computer and simulate, say, a hurricane,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't mean that a hurricane is a computer or that it's a form of computation. I mean, some people would say maybe that it is, but if you use a computer to simulate another information processing entity, you know, like a brain, then it gets very confused. I mean, obviously, of course, that's begging. Edelman, I suppose, would say that's begging the question, because you're saying that it's an information processor that you're simulating, and yet you're not simulating it. I mean, that really is the thing that's acting.
Exactly. So he's saying that the computations, you know, this wasn't, in some sense, it wasn't just a simulation. There were real computations being performed. There was a task that this thing, and you know, when I was talking to him, his argument all involved just using, you know, he called this, the robot, his creature.
Yeah.
He called the computer its brain.
Yeah.
And he insisted that it was learning how to do these things. There
yeah.
was no sort of, there's no pre-planned.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure he's right. It's a, you know, you didn't feed it a program about how to do this. Computers.
But there's lots.
You can program computers to do that. And,
sure, there are yeah. genetic algorithms.
Yeah,
neural networks
exactly.
do this kind of thing. You have all sorts of learning programs. Edelman also, when I had spoke to him, had emphasized that, you know, in a normal computation in a computer, if one step is screwed up, then the whole program is screwed up and you don't get the performance that you want.
Yeah, again,
which isn't
it's a
true
parody
at all.
Of what
yeah.
really happens. Yeah,
right.
There's all kinds of redundancy.
So, you know, the issue that this raised for me, this plus Wolf Singer, and, you know, this is something that you and I, it's sort of a binding theme of both of our careers, is how do you tell, I mean, clearly this is an extremely accomplished, brilliant person,
yeah.
And he's sort of crossing the line from being a great scientist, and in immunology,
mm-hmm.
you know, apparently there's no dispute over of what he's
no.
discovered.
No, and there's no, of course, there's also no dispute that Brian Josephson made a great discovery with the Josephson junction, and superconductivity.
Right.
So,
but they sort of, Josephson clearly and Edelman arguably have crossed the line from being geniuses to cranks.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in a way, my whole career, and as I said, I think this is true of you, is how do you tell the difference between a genius and a crank?
Yeah, I think I'm just less sure that I can do it.
Right.
You're a little more confident in your distinctions, but I have I read this profile of Edelman and I thought, wow, this is really right on.
Yeah.
You described him, if I may quote from the American science writer John Horgan, Edelman is like a novelist who risks obscurity, even seeks it, in the hope of achieving a deeper truth. He is a practitioner of ironic neuroscience, one who, unfortunately, lacks the requisite skills. Now, how did he... What did he say when... You know, oh, hi, John Horgan! And, you know, was he icy?
Oh, well, here's the thing. So, I flew from Newark to Lisbon. I'm getting on the plane in Newark, and right in front of me, I see this big, kind of hunched, black-suited, slightly menacing-looking figure, and I realize it was Edelman. He was sitting right behind me.
Oh, you didn't sit next to him, though.
No, thank God.
There's some famous scientist. Was that Gunther Stent? Yeah, he got stuck on a cross-country flight sitting next to Edelman.
Yeah, and he said afterwards, Edelman spent the whole time trying to explain his theory, and Stent said at the end he still didn't get it.
This is the risk of flying first class.
That's right.
I always sit next to the salesman.
It's thank God we didn't sit next to each other. But then when we got to Lisbon, we were met right at the door of the plane by this person from the Gulbenkian Foundation who whisked us through the airport. We didn't even go through customs, got VIP treatment right into a limo. And so I had to say something.
Yeah.
Edelman was just kind of walking along with his head down. So I said, Jerry, hey, how you doing? It's
Jerry?
John Horgan. And sure. And he looked at me and just said, hello. Mm. And, you know, he shook my hand. And, so I tried to, because we had like a 40-minute drive to our hotel in the back of this limo, and so I'm trying to make small talk and say, oh, so you came all the way from California, and he was like, yeah, you know, so he's very terse. So
yeah.
I'm thinking, okay, maybe he actually did read my book, because I'd never heard from him after End of Science came out.
Yeah.
I never heard from anybody who said that he'd read it and was irritated.
Yeah.
And so at this point I thought, maybe he read it and he's just being kind of cool. Or, maybe he's just jet-lagged and just doesn't feel like talking.
Yeah, right. That's how I am all the time. I just get off a plane after a cross-country flight, and I just want people to leave me alone.
Yeah, and, I just had a bunch of coffee. I was all sort of jittery and chattery.
Yeah.
But then I let him be. We didn't really interact for the rest of the meeting until I gave my talk, which was right at the end of the conference.
Yeah.
He'd already given his talk. And then I gave my end of science shtick, and I focused really on neuroscience and said that I thought it had made pathetically little progress, all sorts of theories, all too many theories of consciousness, very little progress in understanding mental illness, all these benchmarks you have for determining progress, and none of those had been passed. And so I felt like it went pretty well, and I went off the stage, and George Steiner, he was thrilled because I was really the only person other than he who actually addressed the limits of science.
Yeah.
And so he and I were talking, and then I see Edelman kind of bearing down on me from outside of this pack of people, and he came right up to me, and he just had this like demonic look, and he sort of hissed it, so not many people could hear what he was saying, and he said, I have held my tongue all these years, but now I shall have my say. And,
wow.
And he just, told me,
it's like the Wizard of Oz,
moron I was, a horrible person, and that my whole career was based on envy of science, scientists, who had actually accomplished something with their lives, unlike me, and, you know, going on and on about how ignorant and stupid I and I was just kind of, well, you know, I didn't protest. I figured I'd really, you know, I'd given him a pretty severe blow, and I just let him talk. And
so you didn't beg to differ?
No, I mean, what was the point? Let him get it off his chest. Yeah. And apparently, Peter White didn't say this in his post about the reception to my talk, but then apparently he went around to all the other speakers and to the Gulbenkian organizers and said, I think we can all agree that this was an absolute disgrace to have let this person say these things in public, and, you know, he's you know, an embarrassment to science journalism and all this stuff.
But the conference was called Limits of Science, right? I mean,
yeah.
And everyone else just talked about their pet theory and
recycled
something they already had on the laptop. Yeah. And not everyone, maybe, but that's how these things usually are.
Yeah, so even Peter White, he was taking all these shots at string theory.
Yeah.
But he then said, you know, his thing is that experimentally we've reached a dead end, but new ideas from mathematics can take physics forward.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, so everybody wants to be hopeful, and I'd like to be hopeful, too. I actually said that, you know, I threw out a couple of big science problems that I thought might be solved. One was the neural code, but I said maybe, you know, if the Pentagon controlled that knowledge, then that might be a problem.
Mm.
And then I said, you know, my shtick about the end of war.
Right, right.
So.
Yeah, so, you know, it wasn't totally negative.
No. But it was, that was a trip when Edelman finally, and then when we flew back the next day, I'm in the Continental Lounge in Lisbon and chilling out, and then, sure enough, Edelman comes walking in and sits down right next to me.
ESP. I mean, it's it's not ESP. There's some psychic magnetism that means that your worst enemy will end up encountering you at moments like this. But anyway, and then he was all just fine, I'm guessing.
Well, just...
Just fine? Like, oh, yeah, I mean, or not?
Oh, well, no, I mean, you know, we're not going to be friends. but as I said, I did get along with Lewis Wolpert. It was funny.
Yeah, that's good.
Because Wolpert was, you know, I feel like I have a lot in common with him, because after almost every talk that he heard, I'd say, so, Lewis, what did you think of that? Like Wolf Singer. So, Lewis, what'd you think of Wolf Singer, you know, saying we should study ESP? Rubbish. Rubbish.
Yeah, you know, you didn't eviscerate Wolpert in The End of Science. I don't think he's in there, is he?
No, but in my next book, I mentioned this scene where he'd come up to me in London and was screaming at me for saying that neuroscience is over. So I put it in, but just kind of in a, you know, in a jokey way.
Yeah, yeah.
But I actually have a serious disagreement with him, and this has to do with this demarcation problem between, you know, how to distinguish between real science and pseudoscience that is sort of, you know, we're sort of touching on here. Wolpert wrote a book, I don't know if you've read it or seen it, called The Unnatural Nature of Science. The theme, the argument, is that all real science violates common sense. And common sense, whatever that might be, is an impediment for discovering how the world actually works.
Well, I think that, yeah, I think you can make a strong case for that, don't you?
No.
No?
No, I actually wrote an essay.
I'll have to read that. But
For the Times,
it came
out a couple...
Quantum mechanics, general and special relativity, those completely defy common sense.
That's right, that's the thing. But I think the incredible success of quantum mechanics and relativity and other sort of counterintuitive, really strange ideas in physics in the early 20th century, together with psychoanalysis, which also was a totally preposterous thing.
Science.
I want to have sex with my mother. I wanted to have sex with my mother when I was two years old.
That's not a good target, though, because you know, I think hardly anyone, any neuroscientist, would consider psychoanalysis to be or have been a science.
Ah, but you're wrong there, George. Gerald Edelman thinks that Freud is one of the major theorists of the of the mind we've ever had. So, so does Eric Kandel, another Nobel laureate.
Well, I would think Kandel would demand some sort of physical mechanism. Involved.
Kandel was trained in psychoanalysis.
Well, yeah, that's true. I remember that. And then, and yet he's like the ultimate reductionist.
But he believes, he's written some great essays about how he hopes that neuroscience will eventually come back to psychoanalysis. There will be some Freudian ideas that will be disproven, but Kandel feels very strongly that there's a core within psychoanalysis that will be reaffirmed by neuroscience.
I'll have to look into that. I actually just checked out his autobiography or memoir, whatever it is, from the library, and with an intention of reading that. It's supposed to be good.
Oh, that should be the Freud stuff, I'm sure.
It must
be
in there. Yeah, I mean, I just know his work with the aplysia, you know, the snails, and just this amazing research he did on how, you know, the volume level of synapses is turned up and down when you're doing habituation and sensitization and that kind of thing. And I did know, now that I think about it, that he was trained as a psychoanalyst, but I guess I would have assumed that he had jettisoned all that.
Well, he became disillusioned with the lack of testability.
Yeah, well.
But he feels very strongly. So I interviewed him for my second book, mm-hmm. and we talked about this. He feels very strongly that he benefited from psychoanalysis. And as I said, he's written a bunch of papers on this future integration of psychoanalysis and neuroscience.
I gotta look into that.
But the larger issue I wanted to make
about common sense.
And this is what I tried to say in this Times piece, which was, you know, I ended up getting a lot of blowback from this thing, was that those theories early in the 20th century, and I really focused on physics, quantum mechanics and relativity, made us almost equate preposterousness, strangeness,
intuitiveness. This was an op-ed piece.
With truth.
Yeah.
And I said, that's fine to an extent, and especially if you have a theory, you know, it can be strange, but then it's confirmed by experiments. Okay, wow, that's quantum, you know, the world is quantum on some level. That's hard to believe, but the data persuade us that it's so.
Yeah.
But then I think that this notion of exoticness being sort of a value in itself.
Yeah, that's a different argument, though, from saying that that common sense can be basically constrain the mind from finding out the way the world really works. I mean, that's just been shown again and again to be true, going back to even Galileo, where the laws of acceleration in the gravitational field defy common sense.
Well, I guess it depends how you use common sense. So, for example, what I said in this piece was that if you've got a theory, like string theory, obviously, is very strange.
Yeah.
And it's postulating extra dimensions
and
you know, particles that are actually sort of little loops or
okay, yeah, lines. So what you're saying is the fact that it's weird doesn't mean...
No, but then you have to ask, where's the evidence? So common sense tells me that if there not only is there no evidence now, but there probably is no conceivable evidence that will convince us that strings are right, then common sense tells me that this is a dead end.
Yeah.
And I said, actually, when it came to theories of the mind, that if you have a whole century of different paradigms becoming very popular and then sort of fading away. Mm-hmm. So psychoanalysis and behaviorism and cognitive models, and then now Darwinian models are all the rage. Psychopharmacology, one after another, they sort of come and go.
Yeah.
then you common sense would tell you to be extremely skeptical of the next one that comes along.
Yeah,
it's a modest claim.
I guess I'd have to see what Wolpert says in his book. I'm not sure how I managed to miss that.
Yeah, that's what I'm... Wolpert is sort of saying that counterintuitiveness, as I said, is sort of a value in itself, and okay. I just disagree with it, because there are an infinite number of stupid counterintuitive theories out there.
Yeah, but then common sense shouldn't be a value in itself either. Because a lot
except in the ways that I'm talking about.
I mean, phlogiston was a real commonsensical theory of combustion. And Lavoisier showed something that no one would ever imagine was true.
It's kind of, you know how when you're listening to a scientist who's obviously brilliant and has a very sophisticated argument for his theory, it's got lots of moving parts, and some of these scientists just try to dazzle you.
Yeah.
So with somebody like Gerald Edelman, especially earlier in my career, I just would have gone, holy shit, wow, this guy, this is so deep, I don't understand it.
So
therefore,
it
must be right. It's just beyond my humble intelligence. And, you know, the longer I was in this business, the more I trusted my sort of my bullshit detector.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, you know, he says, this is, the brain isn't a computer. Here, let me show you how my computer demonstrates my theory. And I'm going, what the?
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's a common sense reaction, right?
Yeah, yeah. The emperor had no clothes.
Yeah.
Imperial clothes detecting instinct.
Right.
Hey, you know, I was thinking, you know, we should do some real science. We've been talking about all this really wild stuff, and you're talking about science that is actually subject to experiment. So,
uh-huh.
As a science times first, I'm going to try to do an experiment right here, right now.
Oh, far out!
How does that sound?
Well, I'll have to wait to see it.
I'll give you a blow by blow description here. Now,
okay,
it's going to involve me having to change cameras, which I will do now.
Oh, man, you're really taking it to the next step.
I know, we're really pushing the envelope here. Okay, now, if you were able to see what the audience is seeing, you would see this weird device, which is on the desk on the other side of my room. And this is called a Wimshurst machine, which was invented in the 19th century by James Wimshurst. And it's basically a static electricity generator. Okay, I've moved over to the machine now. And there are these two plates made in this case out of plexiglass, and when you turn the crank, it starts spinning in opposite directions, and then there's a spark that jumps between these two electrodes. So what's happening,
George,
is it's charging these two Leyden jars, you know, which is what Franklin played around with his lightning. And these sparks are jumping like about a 1-inch gap here.
Now, I can't.
I think you can probably hear
I think
the spark.
That spark is interfering with your reception.
Ah, okay. Now I'm holding up a book so you can see the spark. Now, can you hear me? The electromagnetic field actually scrambled my wireless phone signal.
Yeah,
cool.
I couldn't. I.
Wow.
Hey, it's like one of those cell phone jammers.
Yeah, okay. So that's. Okay. That was. Anyway, I calculated, so the spark is jumping 1 inch, and there's something called the dielectric breakdown voltage of the air, which is it's about 3,000 volts a millimeter. So that means that by turning this crank on this little machine, I'm generating, 1 inch, I'm generating about 75,000 volts.
Holy shit,
of electricity.
Jesus.
So isn't that cool?
Could you have a fatal accident?
No, actually, when you see the video, you'll see at the end I touched the two electrodes and got a bit of a shock. But even when you take off a wool sweater on a dry winter day, if you see a spark that's jumping like an inch, which is possible, or even half an inch, this is like tens of thousands of volts of very low current electricity.
Geez, I used to work at a electrical engineering magazine, and
yeah.
I should know this stuff.
But isn't it just this is so wonderfully mysterious. I mean, we have these theories that explain what's happening and how the Wimshurst machine with the two plates moving in opposite directions are building up this charge of electrons, and then you actually see the sparks go and you smell the ozone in the air, and you know, it makes it all seem very real and visceral in a way that I'm really starting to appreciate after reading about too much string theory.
That's really a this is inspired. I feel like I should be doing these sorts of things myself.
I'll try to do one of these every time we get together, because I have something. The best one I have is something called a Rumskorff coil that'll put out about 300,000 volts. But
one thing that
one's dangerous.
I think the very last word at the conference was given to Freeman Dyson, and he said, he spelled out this vision of the future of science that I thought was really beautiful. Mm-hmm. He said that he thought, you know, Dyson is, he's really sort of a democratic grassroots type of scientist.
Yeah.
He hates big institutions.
In a real romantic, in all the best ways.
I feel like, you know, there's a part of me that is thinking of objections to it, but I sort of suppress that because it is such a beautiful romantic vision. Basically, he says that the cost of computation and of scientific instruments will continue to go down so much that anybody can play the game of science. You can have poor people in the third world, young people all around the world can play the game of science, and who knows where it will go.
Oh, that's
then.
Wonderful.
Yeah, some of this is a little alarming because he actually said that...
Well, the genetic engineering kit that you'll be able to...
It's
great to be able to do this stuff in your own home, I think, instead of... You know, I mean, even, you know, in science classes now, it's all, they're showing computer simulations of these things instead of the real hands-on. You know, I remember taking a science class, a mandatory part of the science, part of the program, and I think I was in the eighth grade, and you know, when we'd have science, like, one morning a week, and they'd take out these old Crookes tubes and Geissler tubes and fire them up with high voltage generators, and it was really cool stuff. So I've been kind of accumulating these things on eBay and doing them myself.
Oh, I was going to ask you where you got. So you get it on eBay rather than some of these science instrument.
This Wimshurst machine's a real inexpensive one. It's actually sold by a science supply company, but they happen to sell through eBay. And it took me the longest time to get it adjusted to where it would work, but the other things I have, like this coil that I have, is from the Czech Republic, and I'll hook that up sometime. That'll probably blast the phone signal, you know, completely.
Jeez, you know,
I don't know what this
George,
is doing to my neighbor's TV, but
George, you could become the. I don't even know if Scientific American has this anymore, but they used to have.
Oh, the amateur scientist.
Yeah, it was one of their greatest features. I've met a lot of scientists who became scientists because they were inspired by.
Yeah, I found it inspiring when I was a kid, but I don't do these things, you know, really precisely enough, probably. I just mostly enjoy the spectacle and just this, you know, just the feel that, wow, electricity.
Well, so maybe I'm going to make my kids watch your experiment.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we talked about GarageBand television, so this is GarageBand science.
Yeah, that's great.
Well,
so, I don't think we can do better than ending right there.
Yeah, I think we're getting to that time, but that was good. I really wish I'd been there in Lisbon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You would have. They would have benefited from you being there. It would have been more fun. But they will both get invited to one of these things someday.
Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah, it'd be fun to write about.
So anyway, I guess I'll be back. We'll be back next week.
If we do it again, that'd be good. Yeah, we need to catch up on some more stuff here.
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, and I'll haul out the Rumskorff coil and see if that works.
Can't wait to see it.